Welcome back to the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian today. This month, the American Psychiatric Association announced that it is pushing back the publication of the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, more commonly known as the DSM-5, until the year 2013. The APA had previously planned publication in 2012. The book is hugely significant in the field of mental health, psychiatry, psychology, and beyond, and the delay in the publication of the long-awaited fifth edition is generating some considerable controversy. We welcome your calls on this segment in particular. Any mental health workers, psychiatrists, psychologists who rely on the DSM-4 in your work, and those particularly who may care about the delay in the next edition, please call us. Tell us why. 212-433-WMYC. That's 212-433-9692, or you can post at WMYC.org. Click on the Brian Lehrer Show. In the meantime, to help us understand why the DSM has become so important and why the delay is disappointing to some and not so disappointing to others, we are joined by Christopher Lane. He is the Pierce Miller Research Professor at Northwestern University, where he teaches, among other things, and writes about the history of psychology and psychiatry. He also writes for the New York Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, and many other publications. And he's going to help us put all of this in context. Professor Lane, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right. First of all, for those of us who are not in the field but nevertheless find it fascinating, and most people do, help us understand this Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. I actually own one. I am not a psychiatrist or psychologist. I'm an attorney by training. The thing is 4 inches thick. When did it first come onto the scene? I guess that would have been the DSM-1. And how important is it really in the larger context of psychiatry and psychology, et cetera?
Well, the first edition of the DSM was published in 1952, and it was really a very thin, spiral-bound edition with very sketchy descriptions of mental disorders. There were just over 100 listed in that edition. By the time DSM-4 was published in 1994, the edition had become 7 times longer. And it now includes around 300 diagnoses. These are very important for chiefly reimbursement from your health insurer. If you go to a psychiatrist or a psychotherapist and they are looking to reimburse you for treatment with your health insurance, they need a code. They need some kind of description for the health insurers to get reimbursement. But it's also a hugely important manual in terms of signaling what we define as mental illness and what we consider to be an absence of mental illness, which is to say normality. And the controversy that is surrounding this is partly over the proposed inclusion of many new behaviors that a lot of people would consider relatively normal. Let's say bitterness. Let's say apathy. There is a proposal to include sex addiction. There's even a great deal of discussion right now as to what constitutes prolonged grief. So there is a proposal for complicated grief or prolonged grief syndrome and so on. And I was able to document what happened in 1980 with the publication of DSM-3. Where 112 new disorders were included, partly because I was given access to the papers of the American Psychiatric Association, and it was very alarming what I saw. I mean, there was a great deal of carelessness, and there was a great deal of jockeying for people to include their own pet research projects, which were funded by the drug companies. So a lot of the controversy right now is trying to get the drug companies out of the picture, and yet the vetting process is becoming very complicated. At least more than half of those participating have ties to the drug companies.
All right. So the delay is somewhat substantive, somewhat political, and now it sounds as though it is somewhat pharmaceutical.
It is. It is. I mean, there are a number of things going on here. So let's break it down. There's the official line coming from the American Psychiatric Association, which said last week that it's looking to publish the best, most reliable edition possible based on rigorous science. So they're saying they're downplaying any sense of controversy and saying we're simply looking to put out the best possible edition. On the pages of Psychiatric News, however, erupted last year a fight, basically a feud between the current editors and the former editors of the manual, which got so low at one point that they were talking about royalty issues. And this is perhaps not insignificant, as the DSM, since the year 2000, has the royalties have exceeded $40 million. So it's a very important manual around the world. It's invoked in courts. It's invoked in the prison systems, social workers, psychiatrists. I mean, it's hugely influential in all of these fields. Then among the psychiatrists themselves, there's a great deal of disagreement over the criteria for many of the proposed new disorders, including whether, in fact, they even are mental illnesses. There have been delays over the vetting procedure, and there's this history of controversy, as I said, over earlier editions of the diagnostic manual, including whether what is listed there as mental illness, in fact, it constitutes true pathology. So you have, as I've documented in Shyness, how normal behavior became a sickness. All of the debates around social phobia, social anxiety disorder, which included criteria such as fear of eating alone in a restaurant, avoidance of public restrooms. And then they included, in 1987, public speaking anxiety, which has to be one of the most prevalent anxieties going. But it's largely situational. It's something that affects people, you know, during meetings and during presentations. But thereafter, they're not suffering from a mental illness.
But within the DSM, is it only to document the or to list the most severe of psychological disorders, or does it acknowledge a range of psychological disability?
Well, it
phobias all the way to psychosis.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. It does try to specify that a certain number of criteria must be met for a diagnosis to occur. So it lists these criteria, which are very broad and very general, and people would look at them with astonishment, most people. But then it says, a diagnosis can occur only if, say, 5 of 8 of these occur in the patient. The problem is that most psychiatrists are meeting with their patients for a very short period of time, sometimes as little as 7 minutes, before they make a diagnosis. It's simply impossible to establish in that short amount of time how many of those criteria are being reliably manifesting themselves. So you've got that issue, and then the fact that although the DSM tries to be very rigorous and scientific, the people using it, unfortunately, are not applying the same rules in quite the way intended. And so as we've seen, simply, in 1994, when a national comorbidity survey was done, the conclusion was that almost half of the country could at some point meet the criteria for a DSM-4 diagnosis. That's an astonishing state of affairs.
Yeah,
and I think for many people, a very alarming one.
Yeah, I only smile because I know at my office, I work in an office where we deal a lot with people who are involved in the criminal justice system, but
sure.
We are not. We simply represent them, and we spent considerable time looking ourselves up in the DSM-4, and most of us could find some disorder that we could apply to ourselves in the DSM-4. I'm Jamie Floyd. I'm in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Christopher Lane. He's a professor at the Pierce Miller Research. He's the Pierce Miller Research Professor at Northwestern. And people should know that you teach history of psychology and psychiatry, which is just fascinating. And we're talking about the DSM-5. It's delayed in its publication until May 2013. We want to take your calls, 212-433-WMYC, 212-433-9692. Now, Professor, you've suggested in your blog a civil war in psychiatry.
Well,
what does that mean? Over the DSM-5, over the DSM itself, or a larger, broader, more complicated debate over what these various diagnoses mean?
This was actually a quote from New Scientist, which in its latest edition published a devastating editorial and article on the current feuding between the DSM editors, and it called it Psychiatrist's Civil War. And the editorial was called Time's Up for the Diagnostic, or for Psychiatrist's Bible. One of the major issues being worked out here is over the proposal to include what is called sub-threshold or pre-morbid diagnoses, and this is where it gets quite serious, particularly for the diagnosis of children and the medication of children. Mm-hmm. If you permit pre-morbid or sub-threshold diagnosis, you're basically supporting what is called the kindling theory of mental illness in children, which is to say, in a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old, or sometimes actually even 1 or 2-year-old, you can see the beginnings, the traits, if you like, of what might subsequently burgeon into something like bipolar disorder. And on the basis of those traits, a number of psychiatrists, including those very much pushing for the inclusion of this language and these terms, are saying we should be able to stamp out these problems if this 1 or 2-year-old is given an antipsychotic or an antidepressant in time. Now, of course, this is hugely controversial,
yes,
not least because these drugs have not been reliably tested on children or actually toddlers and infants in this case. But in the second case, there is absolutely no reliable evidence, scientific or otherwise, to suggest that one can predict that these traits will burgeon into a full-blown mental disorder.
Yeah.
The problem being that if you're giving an antipsychotic, which is a very powerful medication, to a toddler, you can be doing untold damage to the central nervous system, to the development of the brain, to the brain chemistry. It's very, very dangerous to proceed on those terms. But there are also very, very big implications for public health, for the mental health, and the general population.
Yeah, and it becomes much more than simply a very fascinating theoretical conversation.
Sure.
It has very practical and medical implications. We do have a call from Elizabeth in Metuchen, New Jersey. Elizabeth, mm-hmm, you're on WNYC with Dr. Lane.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Please go ahead.
I just wanted to say that as a practitioner, I find that the DSM, I've worked with severely mentally ill adults in a partial hospital setting. I've worked with substance abusers, and I've worked in private practice with what people would consider a relatively, quote, normal population. And I find that from an educational standpoint, the DSM is very important for understanding how clusters of symptoms come together to form a disorder. But on a practical level, in terms of dealing one-on-one with patients, the DSM, I think, has been given far too much importance. And I think that comes in part from the fact that we're required to use it in order to get paid by insurance companies. Mm-hmm. But when you're sitting down with another human being, it might be helpful to theoretically have an understanding of symptom clustering. But if using the DSM to affect how you're treating the patient in the moment is oftentimes not actually helpful.
That's a very good point, Elizabeth makes, and I would underscore that by saying, I mean, there are many serious disorders listed in the DSM that need to be taken very seriously, including around the psychoses. There are also a whole cluster of mood disorders and personality disorders that are far more open-ended and ambiguous. And I think, as Elizabeth was saying, the fact that one is required to use it gives it undue importance, makes it seem as if one can invoke it chapter and verse, and it's called the Bible and it's given the kind of authority that makes it seem unquestionable. And actually, I think what the New Scientist is trying to do is to open that up and to say we need far greater transparency over the issues here in terms of these discussions being worked out in secret as they currently are. But on the second hand, we need a far more public debate among psychiatrists and physicians as to the use of this and the undue importance that's given to it.
Elizabeth, you wanted to add something else.
I did want to add just one other thing. I also dislike, as a practitioner, the fact that after I've been forced to give a diagnosis, that diagnosis stays with that client forever,
mm-hmm,
on their insurance records,
mm-hmm,
and that there is no way of them having that taken out of their permanent history.
Yeah.
And if they that can be used against them later. And I'm very reluctant to give a strong diagnosis, especially when I work with adolescents, because you don't know how much of it is part of normal development, especially when you're not dealing with the severe illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and the psychoses. You're reluctant to stamp them with something that they're going to have permanently, and yet we're really essentially forced to do so if we want to make a living.
It's a very good point, and I think this is simply underscoring what sense of a double bind people feel in terms of this manual that they have a kind of enforced professional reliance upon it, which gives it great undue importance, and at the same time. We can see. I hear from the clinicians and psychiatrists that I interview that many of them go for the NOS diagnosis, the not otherwise specified, because it gives them a kind of leeway, but it also gives recognition of the fact that that diagnosis will stay on the person's medical records for life, and so it's a very, very serious code to add to their records. And once again, one needs to think about the differences between some kind of situational anxiety or depression versus the lifelong pattern diagnosis that's been given by the DSM when you add it to the medical record.
And yet, Professor Lane, it does seem that clinicians and practitioners, psychiatrists, agree that it is useful as a tool, and that to have some sort of central book, some sort of guideline, is helpful. What do you see as the future of the DSM, especially given now all that you've shared with us in terms of the internal disagreement, the press for transparency? Will we in fact see it in 2013 May, as has now been promised? What do you predict?
Well, one of the key things I want to specify is that I don't think there is unanimity over the importance of the manual. That's a key point to make. In fact, even the fact that the former editors of it have come forward talking about the fact that they're extremely worried about there being no constraints on the degree of change, that there is a likely, this is a quote, wholesale imperial medicalization of normality and a deluge of unneeded medical treatments. Suggests that there is actually a change of heart from the previous editors, who are very worried about potential misuse here. So that's the first thing. The second thing is my basic agreement with the new scientist that if the manual were updated online and with all due forms of transparency, the suggestion that it would remain a Bible would disappear, and there would be a far greater understanding of how open-ended and ambiguous it is and how provisional many of these diagnoses are. So I think, particularly with the debate that's unfolding right now over healthcare reform and the fact that the health insurers are balking at the enormous costs of reimbursement from a DSM diagnoses, there will be a push to lessen the authority of the manual, and I think that's fundamentally a good thing for the general public, who are often saddled with these diagnoses for life, when the language informing them and the decisions that make those diagnoses are often insufficient or unreliable.
Well, thank you so much. It's been very, very enlightening. Professor Christopher Lane of Northwestern University, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
And coming up next, there are so many reasons to love New York, and that special New York Magazine edition is out. We'll talk with the senior editor, and we want you to call us with your reasons that you love New York, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. That's coming up next.